You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
And welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, through this half hour of culinary history. And today I have a question to pose to all of you, and that is, what is America's national dish? Do we have one? And by the same token, what is our national cuisine? That is really something that food writers have been grappling with for a long time. As I paraphrase something here that appeared in a presentation at the New York Public Library recently, food writers consistently proclaimed that America had no national dish. Some food writers took this observation further and claimed that America had no national cuisine. And yet, although there was nothing to write about, cookbook compilers and journalists spent a great deal of time describing American food. And indeed, yes, our shelves. I was counting my bookshelf, which I have a rather extensive cookbook collection, has been compiled over many years, and the bottom shelf is all American, and I just did a quick count this morning to see, and there must be over 55 books just on the shelf, on the front of the bottom shelf alone, devoted to American cuisine. So if we have no national cuisine, we have an awful lot of books about them. So today I have with me Megan Elias, and Megan is the author of a couple of books, one in particular called Stir It Up, Home Economics in American Culture, and also Food in the United States from 1895 to 1940. She's well prepared to talk about American cuisine. Megan is associate professor of history at City University's Queensborough Community College, and she is currently a writer in residence at the New York Public Library's Wertheim Study. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you.
Megan, what made you explore this whole notion of American cuisine or a national dish, or looking at our food and do we have a particular food?
Well, it started when I was writing about nutritionists, about the history of nutrition, and I found a lot of critiques about the kind of food that nutritionists were writing about, the kind of cookbooks that they put together, sort of archetypal American recipes, and people saying, you know, this is nutritionists have no sense of taste, they have no sense of palate. And I started to wonder about that and then to look more about critiques of American food. And I found that it's very, very accepted in American food writing to say American food is disgusting, essentially, that it's bad, that it's not food. And so the implication then is that in an entire nation of people who, live in a situation of bounty, eat food that's terrible, and they keep eating it. And so I was wondering, it's not true, as far as I can tell, right? But why is this a kind of pervasive theme in American food writing? And so that it's okay to say Americans eat disgusting food and they love it, and not to say that about any other culture in the world.
And this is taken on food going into homes or just in
everywhere
and cafes across. Wow, that's interesting, because it's certainly not my take on American food.
Right.
And having grown up in the Midwest as well, which, you know, they say, oh, Midwest cooking is all so bland and awful. Not true again to my, you know,
right, because you like it.
Exactly. It's because I like it. However, as we were discussing before the show, there was a question posed as what is Midwestern mm-hmm. cuisine, and the immediate answer from so many people came back, casseroles.
And, yes, definitely. Yeah. And there are reasons for that. I mean, there are reasons for the kind of casseroles that Americans seem to like and to still like that they that the kind that are made from a couple of different contents of different cans, and you put things together and you put something on top. Maybe it's you know, something from a box. It's either the onion, the crispy onions, or the cornflakes or something, and that there are good reasons that kind of cuisine emerged, that it comes out of a shift in middle class housing, and just the availability of canned stuff, that when it was new, people were excited and they experimented with it. Right.
That was post-war. And of course, Laura Shapiro, we were talking about earlier, she wrote a wonderful book on and talking about frozen foods and box mixes and cans. And yes, and this was supposed to, you know, this was supposed to relieve the woman of the house from the drudgery of the kitchen.
Right. And this is the kind of really interesting thing about this is that in the by the 30s, most middle-class American women didn't have household help, but their mothers had. So in their mothers' households, they had not learned how to cook because someone else was doing the cooking. So they have to come into the kitchen and actually start cooking, and they've never been trained to do it. But then on top of it, cooking is something that servants do. So you want to avoid it as much as possible. And if you can turn it into this kind of, you know, half an hour of creativity,
quick and easy,
just throwing stuff together, and it's something that no one has ever had before. You know, we have to remember that the casseroles and Jell-O salads were incredibly exciting at one point because they represented something completely new. Mm-hmm. And this is this longstanding, since the 1930s, critique of American food, is that Americans are interested in progress in food, and that a true cuisine is one that sort of doesn't change.
Right.
So
right.
As people are critiquing American food as being the, you know, constantly changing and constantly looking for new, improved, you know, did it go to the moon, then I want to eat it, that kind of food, that they're also sort of creating this mythology of French food as a never-changing entity. And French food is good and American food is bad. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy that we could, it's sort of almost taken for granted in American food writing that the French know about food. They care. They love food. But the Americans, they just don't know about food. Yeah. If they knew about food, they would eat French food. You know? So it gets sort of funny, but also sort of disheartening sometimes.
Well, and look how far we've come as a country. I mean, we are still, I always claim, and when I've had these discussions with other guests that on the air, that we are still culinarily a very young country. And we have progressed so far. We didn't for a long time, but now we have progressed, you know, so far, so rapid. If you look at where we've come now, how it's tipped the scale in the other direction, at least in the metropolitan areas on either coasts. I think you can still travel coast to coast through a lot of cities, and you get some of that bland food where I don't know where product is not but products are available. I was going to say product availability was limited, but products are available everywhere
and
now.
And they always have.
And now we've got the most innovative cuisine, and in fact, a lot of the restaurants in France and across the rest of Europe are adopting a lot of the innovations that are coming out of the haute cuisine, if you will, of America.
Yeah.
And that's so it really is. You're right. There has been progress.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's what
you don't think there's progress.
I think there's this kind of longstanding and it pops up in cookbooks and in Gourmet magazine over and over again, this idea that America is making progress. But what does that mean, progress? Like, it's always the progress is sort of more towards a European style of thinking about food.
Mm.
So they say, okay, we're getting somewhere. And you see them saying it in the 1890s, we're getting somewhere. We're starting to learn how to cook French. Then in the 1930s, we're getting somewhere. We're getting rid of prohibition. We're starting to use wine. The 40s, we're getting somewhere, right? Some of us have been to France. We've picked up some, you know, proper food styles. And then it keeps going. So it's always, we're going somewhere. And I think what I'm trying to see is, why do people keep writing that way, right? Why is it always this constant narrative of progress, which you don't see in writing about other...
Rather than we are.
Yeah,
and we
exactly.
Have.
This is what Americans eat. Americans like hamburgers and hot dogs. Why is that not... Why is that something that we have to keep questioning, right?
Well, it's interesting because in positing this question about what is America's national cuisine, or what is America's national dish? It's a difficult one to answer because you have to, first of all, put a face on an American.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there's, of course, there's no national dish. There are things that are sort of representative of a lot of Americans, but not of everybody. And And this is the other thing that I keep pursuing in these cookbooks is why? Why do we need a national dish? Why do we need a national cuisine? And it's, again, it's on this sort of French model of culture. The French have a cuisine. So in order to be sort of high culture, you need a cuisine. And, you know, that's it's just a construction. It's not necessarily true or false. Yes.
And even those countries are changing. Their face is changing, too, with, you know, they're accepting more immigrants and they've got a changing population. But we were formed on a multicultural population.
Yes.
So
it
would it's difficult to even assume that we would think that we have one particular national dish. Although I did ask the question of a few people and the answers, I didn't really get that many answers, the answers I did get were interesting because it's their way of thinking. And what is America's national dish? I got answers like pot roast, which you can tie back to European beginnings, of course. Hamburger, which is debatable, but, you know, true. Apple pie, again, once the, you know, European. I think barbecue chicken, southern fried chicken. But I think the one that won was peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yes. Yeah, and it's representative of a lot of things that people say about American food. A lot of the longstanding critiques are that it's a nation of people who don't want to stop. So you get a sandwich and you go. And also that it's a kind of, there's this constant critique that Americans don't have a mature palate. So it's sort of childhood food.
Yes.
Although you can't get it everywhere. I'm kind of partial to peanut butter and jelly, especially because it's sort of the cheapest sandwich you can ever buy.
That's right.
And I can't find it everywhere. I kind of have charted out where I can get it, which delis will do it. But
of course, then it has
don't.
To be the right kind of bread and the right kind of jelly.
Yeah, you know? Good luck.
Right. Well, that came from my friend Elizabeth Catherine McGowan, who writes a blog called Comestibles.
Oh.
And she mentioned it because she's married to an Australian who abhors the notion of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So I guess you have to be an American to appreciate the flavor.
It definitely seems to be something that other people do not want to import. There are no peanut butter and jelly chains in, you know, in the rest of the world, like there are hamburger chains.
You said that in talking about American food, food writers trying to define the American cuisine, and certainly cookbooks abound with that.
Yes.
What have been cookbook writing? What have been some of the major changes? You said you mentioned that you could really chart some changes from the end of the Civil War through the demise of Gourmet magazine.
Yeah, and in writing about what American food is, there's this kind of starting that the real critique starts after the First World War. Before that, writing about American food is less critical. So there's a kind of a phase right after the Civil War of regionalist cookbooks, and primarily of the South. So there's a lot of attention to Southern food, and again, creating this dichotomy between the unchanging and the changing, and unchanging being good and changing being bad. So the North is industrialist, and their food is sort of portrayed in Southern cookbooks as kind of soulless. And Southern food is full of soul and character and romance and tragedy, right? Because these are cookbooks that are written by Southerners who lost all their power because they were white and they had to give up. So they're sort of white supremacist cookbooks. Not sort of, they are. But they're very much intent on defining national food through regions. So you've come back together after the Civil War, but you break up kind of regionally through cuisine.
Right. Well, if you look at the history of cookbooks and what's out there, a lot of it, you find popular recipes and things didn't appear in cookbooks so much as they did in pamphlets. Pamphlets were a big part, that ephemera from products and things are a big part of our recipe collection.
And those are some of my favorite cookbooks. They're what I call the corporate cookbooks that came with the refrigerator or the stove or the can of something. And they're just wonderful. They're some of the most beautifully illustrated cookbooks early on when other cookbooks didn't have great illustrations because they're putting money into the illustrations. And they're walking this wonderful line between being innovative and being traditional. So they're giving you something old but new. And my favorite example from this is something called Strawberry Shortcake, which is a really typical American dessert, or had been for a long time. I don't know if it is so much anymore. But this is from a Frigidaire cookbook. Frigidaire, I think this is the Frozen Dainties, which is one of the best cookbooks. And it's so it's strawberry shortcake, something everybody recognizes, but it's made new through the refrigerator. So you see the point of having a refrigerator. Right. And there are these special little...
Oh, you need
the
refrigerator.
You need the refrigerator to make this thing that you've been, your ancestors have been making for hundreds of years. But it's made with sponge cake and strawberries and whipped cream, and then you stick it in the freezer for a while, and it becomes something new. But I love those, the playing with old recipes to make them something exciting to consumers.
And the recipes on the back of boxes of product boxes.
Yes, I'm always drawn to those.
Yes, of course. And there's certain things that you can't really duplicate unless you make it as it's written on the back of the of the box. It's like the chocolate wafers making that icebox cake.
The icebox cake, right. And to remember that there were no icebox cakes until there were iceboxes.
That's right.
So someone had to invent that kind of cooking. And that, again, that's something that Americans are critiqued, and this is by their Americans for doing, is for really jumping on that bandwagon of the, you know, everything new is exciting and tasty. But that's, you know, I think in a sense that's true that they did that. Americans had access to things like icebox cakes or the possibility of the icebox cake before a lot of other people in the world did. I mean, you know, there are still a lot of places where you couldn't make an icebox cake because you didn't have an icebox.
Well, I know that a lot of the early cookbooks, too, and well, after post-war cookbooks, were stressed nutrition, how to be a good housewife, how to put a balanced meal on the table. So they were all-encompassing tomes of home economics, really.
Yeah, not quite home economics because that's more scientific, but trying to take nutritional wisdom and apply it to every day, which didn't always work. I'm just reading a book at the moment that's all about how to live a healthy life, and it's about not combining the wrong foods with each other. This is from 1943, and it really doesn't make any sense at all. Because
it sounds almost like the medieval Renaissance kind of.
Yes, very much. It's very, very like
the
that.
Humorous.
Yeah.
Right?
It's very much like the humorous. Yeah.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go a little further on the cookbook writing and talk about some of that regionality.
Okay.
Right.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I'd deliver. Bad news on the doorstep, I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
We are back talking about America's national cuisine with Megan Elias. And we were talking, Megan, earlier about some of the cookbooks. Now, what we left off around the 30s or the 40s, and just about to get into the regionality and the regional cookbooks. But there's something that actually represents regions, but is another important phase of cookbook writing, and those are the community cookbooks, as you mentioned. You didn't want to talk about it too much.
Yeah.
All those church gatherings, the church cookbooks, the junior league cookbooks, that whatever organization got together.
Yeah, so they start coming out really in the period after the Civil War. Every community has one, and they're for raising money for local projects. And the curious thing about them is that even though they seem to be regional, so it's just from a particular tiny town or small city, they're actually all the same. So you get the same recipes from a cookbook in Ohio that you do from one in Alabama, from one in New York, from one in Massachusetts. And I actually made this, what I call the insane database, which is a database of hundreds of these cookbooks, just in a, you know, a pie section. How many
different recipes for
so
apple
I could
pie?
Find, right? Exactly, and that's what I was saying earlier, was that I actually didn't find very many recipes for apple pie at all. What I found were a million recipes for lemon pie, and then a million recipes for things like lobster Newburgh, mm-hmm. which, you know, obviously in the middle of Ohio, it's a little hard to make a lobster Newburgh, but people wanted to be, they wanted their recipe to represent who they were. And if you gave the lobster Newburgh recipe, you were really saying to everyone in your community, I'm sophisticated, uh-huh. right? If you uh-huh. put the Delmonico crab Delmonico recipe, you're saying, I know about New York. I know about, you know, this sort of cosmopolitan cuisine. So the recipes really, and this is something we're talking about earlier, I think, too, that the recipes, you would think that they wouldn't give a recipe for something that everybody knew how to make, like cornbread, but some people wanted to be known for their
cornbread. For their own recipe, right.
And I'm the cornbread woman, right? And she's the beef a la mode woman, right?
Right. Well, you know, I know that you're familiar with Molly O'Neill's mm-hmm. recent book called One Big Table.
Yeah.
And she was addressing this similar question, or don't Americans cook anymore?
Right,
it was
right.
more her question, and drove all across country cooking with people. Right. And what she said was, she kind of, if you want to distill it down to one answer, which is impossible, that Americans do still cook, and that the American cuisine is really geared to the hometown, mm-hmm. regionality
yeah.
again, and American cuisine is more hometown appetite cuisine.
Right.
And I think that really does wrap things up as far as how people cook,
right.
but not necessarily, as you say, what they want to write about.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's been hard for people to write really about home cooking. But then also, you know, you notice trends, that things trickle down. So you go, you know, what's something like, having dried cranberries on your salad. Mm. You know, that it'll be new on the coasts, and then 5 years later you have dinner in, you know, St. Louis or something, and there are cranberries on the salads, and it's new, and it just, you know, the ideas, and then it's in McDonald's, right?
Right.
And so the ideas kind of filter around, and sometimes, you know, some things never, right, are going to go all the way across the country.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned cookbook, right? Well, then we started, we have well-known authors, cookbook authors
yeah.
came about, and that was a little later, late 40s, early 50s, we started to have a few well-known.
Yeah, that's the beginning of actual food writers, like M.F.K. Fisher, that she's really the first person who just writes food. Other people, there are
And not necessarily recipes either.
Right, yeah, she's the first who writes. I think she's really important because she writes about food as experience.
Right.
And that's still a dominant theme in American food writing, that it's something, it's not just something you eat, it's not something you make for your family, God forbid, right? It's something you make for pleasure, for yourself.
Yeah. But we were such an agrarian society for, you know, a good part of that,
yeah.
at least the inward, you know, when
right.
these people moved west, and it was, you know, sustain yourself, sustenance, and
yeah.
So we finally graduated
to
pleasure.
But also so much bounty that... No, I don't think we did. I mean, I think that's the argument that people make, is that we graduated to pleasure when we learned about French food and how French people eat. But that America has, you know, from an early, early period, really represented a bounty and variety in a way that other nations, especially in Europe, couldn't provide. So Americans always had more possibilities for what could be on their table than anyone else, essentially.
Hmm.
And what they chose to do with it then appears sort of from this 21st century perspective to be, or even, you know, from a mid-20th century perspective, to be not enough, like not interesting enough. So if you take your, you take your fresh corn out of the field and you make it into creamed corn, you're just abusing the bounty that you have. So there's another critique that comes often from Europeans, often after the Second World War, when they've gone through a horrible period of food suffering,
right.
that Americans have all this food and they don't know what to do with it.
Hmm.
But of course, Americans have been eating all of their food in the way that they liked it, and that it shows up in these community cookbooks, for hundreds of years. It just happens to be a different taste, a different palate, right? So it's interesting. It's this kind of this idea of progress and the idea of good food and bad food and knowing about food, which I think is more construction than really a reality, but fascinating construction for me.
What was the major shift that you observed in your research in cookbook writing about those who are writing about American cuisine?
Yeah.
Can you pinpoint anything in
particular? Well, there are some interesting things. There are a couple of interesting things that happened. There's the change in style, which is the M.F.K. Fisher writing about experience, and the big period of critique that comes in the 40s and 50s. And then in the 60s, an attempt to undermine the shift towards experience and the gourmet by trying to get everything done really quickly. So Peg Bracken's I Hate to Cook cookbook is really important because it's saying, like, oh, forget it. You know, give up on that whole Julia Child fantasy and just get something on the table and
eat
it.
And
then get drunk, essentially.
There are some really great recipes.
There are, I mean, there are almost every book I've read has had great recipes of one kind or another. And then in the 70s, in the early 70s, there's a really important shift into talking about food as being dangerous. So thinking about food in terms of the environment. And I think that really resonates with what's going on today, talking about sustainability. And, you know, we're sitting actually under a garden
now.
They're growing all their food in the restaurant. So that talking about the environment, talking about pollution, talking about DDT especially, and so a shift towards trying to think about food as safe or unsafe. And that's a really different way to think about your food and think about the food systems as well.
Right, food system, right.
Yeah.
I think that the whole notion of food systems came into...
Yeah, but early and then kind of sort of got subsumed under the nouvelle cuisine for a little while and then has kind of come back to us in different ways. I mean, now we're talking about the farmer and people didn't really talk about the farmer so much in the 70s.
Right. Yeah. Now we have magazines devoted solely to, you know, to what the farm... I mean, farmers... are the new rock stars of the culinary world. The chefs were for a while, and now it's the farmers. And I think that's very interesting. We're going to see a lot of interesting writing about that.
Farmers writing their own, you know, there's this big sort of market for farmers to write their own stories.
Right.
And again, it's moving back to the idea of food as experience, but then blending it with the idea of food as part of a larger system, which I think it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say the writing, talking about the demise of gourmet... and the writing really was, I can't say it was just, it wasn't definitely not American cuisine, because that was the thrill to open a gourmet magazine and say, oh, what wonderful
Where
exotic
am
place
this
am
month?
I going?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So that was really more of a travel and experience.
And the readers loved it. They wrote in always, the letters in gourmet are really my favorite material. And they wrote in to say, oh, we were just at this little restaurant in Venice, and, you know, this is what we had, and they'd write in and try to get the recipe.
That's right. Could you please, and I think a couple of the different magazines, Bon Appetit as well, you know, we'll publish, we'll try to find them for you if you want.
Yes. And so it's a way for the readers to connect with other readers and to show themselves off in a way,
That's right.
I know the world. My favorite example is this woman who wrote in the 40s, and she wanted a recipe for goulash that she had in a Hungarian restaurant in Tokyo.
Huh.
So she's showing off, I know Hungarian cuisine, I've been to Tokyo, I read gourmet.
Well, I mean, it was often criticized as being elitist, as many cookbooks were as well. But who wants to read about the mundane, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, occasionally, I've sort of charted what American food gourmet wrote about. And this is only up to the late 70s that I've read so far. And they wrote about food stuff. So they'd write about corn, apples, cranberries. But they didn't write about food, about cooking, American cooking, until the late 70s. And then they started getting into, you know, once you get Edna Lewis, I think things open up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Oh, Americans cook interesting food, you know. And, of course, Edna Lewis had sort of come into the food writer's consciousness through a French restaurant, sort
That's
of
right.
pseudo-French restaurant
yeah.
that she worked for. But that it's always about, like, they have this continual series of articles about corn that are always the same, that start with the Indians giving the corn to the pilgrims and every, you know.
And
but never
around,
end up in hush puppies somehow.
I was going to say, that's usually around Thanksgiving time.
Or corn dogs. They never write about corn dogs.
Corn dogs, right. I mean, you can chart a lot of the recipes annually that kind of reappear in a different guise, you know, in each issue of every...
It's November, it's cranberries again.
Magazine, right. I swear they recycle some of those covers, too. Right?
They do, yeah.
But not really. I mean, they don't. But what are you going to do? That really, I think probably that, you know, looking at Thanksgiving dinner, that is really sort of like a time everyone says, oh, it's my favorite holiday.
Right.
It is a really... obviously a very American holiday, but it's a time where we sort of bring together all those family favorites, those family dishes. And I guess that is an epitome of American cuisine, although the dishes aren't strictly American, but it is the hometown cuisine, you know, your home, your family's
cuisine?
Well,
it's pretty interesting. It turns out it's really different regionally. So I actually, mm-hmm. I was invited to talk to some foreign students about what the meaning of Thanksgiving was. And, you know, I asked them and they had some ideas about what sorts of foods they would see on the table. And then I asked students in a class I had who were all, you know, recent immigrants or American born, and their ideas about what would be on the Thanksgiving table were nothing like what I had thought. I'm Northeastern. And they, a lot of them had macaroni and cheese.
Huh.
Macaroni and cheese, no turkey. They had a ham. So it seemed to me that there actually wasn't any standard that I'd assumed all along. Oh, we know what Thanksgiving dinner is.
But these were dishes that to them represented American cuisine. What's interesting.
But they represented Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Huh. Maybe they were the festival foods of that, of whatever culture they came from.
Yeah.
But it made my job sort of harder because I was trying to say, oh, well, I'll tell you the real origin of, you know, the pumpkin pie and go through the whole Lydia Maria Child and FDR story. But they didn't have a pumpkin pie on their table, so I didn't have anything to work with, which is fine, right?
Well, I was surprised, actually, that macaroni and cheese did not come up as an answer for one of the national dishes. I guess because people associated it with being a pasta, so they probably figured, oh, right away that, well, we can't include that.
So funny. No, there's been a macaroni recipe since the 18th century,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mac and cheese is a biggie, right. Well, I really don't know that I want to limit ourselves and say that we have a national dish.
No.
I think it's so wonderful that we are such an international nation and that we really draw upon all these different cultures.
In a way, pizza is one of our national
absolutely.
Dishes, right?
Absolutely. And I think that sounds like a really good lunch to have today. Right, here we are at Roberta's restaurant. What a great thing to have. Well, I look forward to a book. What I didn't mention is that you have a book that's going to be coming out soon called Taste of the Nation, American Cookbooks and Culture, and precisely what we're talking about today. And I really do look forward to reading that book. And we'll have to have you back again and find out what you learned when you wrote that book. So once again, Megan Elias, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this has been A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. There's a lot of posturing and talking around raw milk these days and how great it is. But if you really want to get a full-on investigation into the pros and cons, the risks and benefits of raw milk consumption, here's a nifty website, www.realrawmilkfacts.com. It has a laundry list of FAQs, along with information from studies and reports from American and European science communities. If you flirt with raw milk consumption, this is definitely worth taking a look at. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.